Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to the Bookomi podcast. Original, memorable insights, OMI, from brilliant minds in business, science, tech and culture. It's for leaders who would be readers of new non-fiction, if you had the time, right? In this episode, we meet a social psychologist challenging the notion of power as a means of controlling others.
The purpose of power, I like to remind people, is not the self-enhancement, but the purpose of power actually is to protect groups.
Deborah Grunfeld is the Joseph MacDonald Professor at the Stanford School of Business. She's a regular contributor to The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. And she sits on the board of the LeanIn.org Foundation. Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg says that Deborah's book, Acting with Power, Why We Are More Powerful Than We Believe, will change how you think about power and how you handle it, whoever you are.
No matter how much power people have, everyone has that experience of feeling not quite sure that they're capable of living up to others' expectations of them.
Deborah, can we start by sharing three things or three insights from Acting with Power that you think will be useful for leaders of a company or an organization or a family or just someone who wants to lead a better life?
Definitely. I guess the first insight that I would share is that, most of us, when we think about power as an idea or as a resource, we tend to think of it as a tool for personal consumption and self-aggrandizement. So we think of it as like a resource that we should try to accumulate for our own self-enhancement because it's a measure of self-worth or an accomplishment or an achievement. But if you, zoom out a little bit from the drama that's going on inside all of our heads, what you can see is that power doesn't exist outside of a social context. There is no power in an individual. It's a resource that connects people and makes it possible for groups to coordinate. So the purpose of power, I like to remind people, is not just the self-enhancement, but the purpose of power actually is to protect groups. And this, I think, makes it much easier for people to kind of approach the idea of being a power holder and wielding power as a way of protecting the group and helping the group advance its outcomes. So I would say that's the first one, is just recognizing that the power is a resource that the people we work with and live with entrust in us. They give us special privileges and advantages and rights in exchange for a promise that we'll use that resource to protect their interests too. And it's important not just for the obvious reasons that sometimes people in positions of power, I think, forget what their responsibilities are, but very important for people who can't get comfortable with the idea of themselves as power holders, that actually when you are the person who's holding all the cards, it's important to be able to protect other people and their interests. It just makes it easier to approach, I think. So that's the first insight. The second insight that is very much related, I think, is that we all feel powerless. And I think this is an experience that, there was a time where I thought it was just me who felt that way. I thought it had to do with maybe the fact that I was a woman, maybe it had to do with my relationship with my parents or something that was happening in my family and my family's history. But what I've learned, kind of came as a surprise at the beginning, is that no matter how much power people have, everyone has that experience of feeling not quite sure that they're capable of living up to others' expectations of them. It's just a universal experience. And part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that we learn about power in childhood at a time when we are actually at our most helpless and tend to relate much more to the low power position, being in the low power position and feeling like other people have too much control. And we just carry that association around. So even, very accomplished executives and professionals will find sometimes that they surprise themselves by not having, completely internalized others' perceptions and expectations and even admiration of them, right? It's hard to make the connect between the ways that we feel insecure about ourselves and the reality that sometimes, our power defines us to other people. Even if we can't feel, how great we are, it's the way other people relate to us. So that I think is really important for people to recognize that despite the fact that we feel powerless, others need us to internalize the reality that sometimes others are more vulnerable than we are. That's number two. The third insight I would share, I guess, is that, you know, when the book is called Acting with Power, and there's a lot of interest, I think, in how to project power better through nonverbal behavior in particular. And we have a tendency, I think, to think of power as very much a manifestation of kind of a command and control, very authoritative style. But I guess the final insight that I wanted to share is that sometimes showing deference and respect to others is the best way to maintain the upper hand. And I think that comes as a shock to a lot of people. Like, there's a lot of concern in the audiences that I deal with about appearing weak. And one of the things that I've noticed in observing power holders is that when people really have a lot of power, so they have positional power and authority and they have status, people respect them, they don't have to remind anyone of their position. And so what you'll find often is that humility and deference and showing respect to others when it's not necessary is how power holders actually behave. And I think that's important because people tend to approach this topic thinking, I have to be more tough, I have to be more fierce, I have to be more dominant and make sure no one ever, never see the upper hand. And I think actually, if you look at how power shows up in the real world, it's much more generous. When people really have power, they can afford to show others respect. And I think that's what you tend to see.
That's a lovely way of putting it. So you've been very modest in terms of your openness about feeling powerless sometimes, but you have had a powerful ascent in academia. You know, you lead a course, students rely on you, but you weave a story into the book that's very personal because you felt yourself the focus of a power play and a status play yourself, haven't you? Where you've gone into a situation where people were talking about you and you were people were gossiping about you and you had to really test your mettle, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
You had to really look inside yourself. So explain what happened there and how did that help the book and how does that make the book more human?
Sure. Well, I it's funny when you started to talk about that, I wasn't even sure which example you were talking about because this is just such a fact of life for me. I think what you're referring to is that there was a period in my life, I guess maybe about 5 years ago now or so now, where I went through a difficult divorce and a lot of my personal life was in the news for a short period of time. And, you know, I was portrayed in a way that I wasn't entirely comfortable with. So that was very, very difficult. I had to go back into the classroom knowing that the students at Stanford had read about me and my personal life. Some of my personal texts had showed up in the news. I was very, very anxious about what they would be thinking on that first day and whether they would be able to see me as the person that I hoped to be, which is, you know, a professor who's showing up to teach a class and has something to share, even if I've had an embarrassing moment in my life. And, you know, I guess a couple things I would share about that. I mean, I think the first one is that in thinking about how to prepare myself to go into that situation, knowing that I was feeling very insecure and worried about feeling embarrassed, was that I made the decision to focus all of my energy attention on making sure that they felt okay when they came in. So, and I think this is something that's a theme in the book, and it's something that I've learned from actors, which is that there are techniques you can use to get rid of self-conscious energy. If you can train your attention on the people that you're dealing with and think to yourself, make sure that they're doing okay, all the pain and anxiety that come from worrying about yourself just completely disappear. It's like nothing, you know, you have no resources left to be thinking about yourself. So I made every effort that I could. I think that first day I just was committed to making sure that they felt safe and secure and okay in the classroom and like nothing weird was going to happen there, that we were just there to do what we always do, which was to try to deliver a class that had useful content. I met all of them at the door that day for the for the first day and shook all their hands and tried to remember their names and just, you know, was very, very much focused on making sure that whatever anxiety or uncertainty they had about coming into the classroom, that I was doing everything I could to make sure that it wasn't part of the situation. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing that's, you know, I don't know if it's a source of comfort for people or not, but it is, I mean, everyone, I think, worries to some extent about being exposed, you know, having their worst fears about themselves exposed. And it can lead us to be very closed, I think, in the way we show up. And one of the things that I learned from that experience is that what other people say about you doesn't define who you are, actually. And, you know, once something embarrassing has happened, you can kind of let go of all that fear. It's like, okay, my worst fears have come true. Everything's out there and I can just get on with the rest of my life. But I think it was a very helpful experience for accepting my own humanity and accepting the truth that all of us live with, which is that I have strengths and things to be proud of. And I also have weaknesses and things that I'm still working on. And what I think is an interesting takeaway from that is people worry a lot about authenticity and trying to be authentic and appear authentic. I think the only way we get to authenticity is by accepting more of ourselves so that we don't have to hide anything when dealing with other people. So that experience, I think, in retrospect, was one that made me much less fearful of most situations, but it wasn't enjoyable, let's put it that way. But, you know, I think that, and it's important with regard to the theme of the book in terms of acting too, that I think the best any of us can do is to try to show up every day in whatever roles we're playing in life and be the person we aspire to be on a day-to-day basis. Try to give as much as we can, try to create a base of security for other people, and just focus on the work of trying to make ourselves useful. The great actress Judi Dench has a quote that I sometimes like to use just to remind myself of how to stay focused, keep my eye on the ball, which is that she says that the key to being a good actor, and I think it's the key for all of us to being effective leaders, is to take the work seriously, but not take ourselves very seriously at all.
I saw that quote. That's a great way of putting it. And that's what struck me about the smart title of the book and the role of acting. It can sound pejorative that you're only acting, you're putting on an act. And authenticity and leadership is something that's cropped up over the years when I've worked in leadership roles and all the leaders I work with. Let's be authentic, let's be our true selves. But as Walt Whitman said, we're large, we contain multitudes. I'm one thing one day and another thing the next. So you need a role to pin, you need something to hang your hat on. And what you said about the social contract and the deference that you gave to your students to make it, you know, not about you, but to look after them, is a great piece of advice for anyone, say, speaking or talking in front of a group of people who's nervous. You know, because if you're nervous, it's about you, isn't it? We don't want to make everyone else nervous. So.
Of course. No, that's right. I mean, it's so interesting, you know. I mean, actors have to learn techniques for this because they're people just like the rest of us. And they, you know, have to show up on stage and show up in film and do things they would never do and sometimes really expose themselves. But they have these very useful techniques for just channeling that energy in a constructive direction, as opposed to being in the situation where you're watching yourself do something and then you can't quite immerse yourself in the role that you're trying to play. So the techniques, I think, are really, really helpful.
And the subline to the book is why we're more powerful than we believe. You're not saying that people who are higher up the hierarchy than you have more power. You're just saying they should exert power in a different way and that you have your own power, but you've got to know how to exert that power, how it's within you. Just because you might be a junior in a company or, you know, subordinate to somebody on the hierarchical ladder, that you can still exert power. How does that work? How does that play out? Once you know how, are you talking about reading the room? Are you talking about how you fit in and then exploiting that, leveraging that position?
I mean, to some extent, sure. So I think, you know, one of the important things that people can take away from these ideas is that it's very easy for a person in a subordinate position to abdicate all their power to their superiors. It's a very natural way to behave, to try to play it safe in that way and to sort of stop thinking for yourself and be afraid to speak truth to power. And I try to remind people that, you know, even in those roles, the people who you work for don't have absolute power, because if they need you, you have power too. And it's important to think of yourself, I think, in a subordinate role as a real partner, actually, to the people who you work for, you know, not just someone who's there to try to stay safe and execute on directives, but as someone who, through our own actions, the things that we do can elevate or knock down our superiors if we're not careful and not thoughtful about what we're doing. So yeah, I try to remind people that, and anyone who's in the position of being a boss is very aware of this as well. We are very dependent on the people who work for us, and we depend on them to have our backs and to put our interests first. And so part of being a good subordinate is to recognize that you have that power. You have that power in the relationship. And so you have to get in your boss's corner and have their back. And sometimes that means being deferential and propping them up. And sometimes it means telling them, you know, you're at risk right now. This is not the right approach.
I think it plays out through all societies. You know, you're a teacher and a professor. I don't know if you had it in the States when you were a kid. Did you ever see your teachers out of school or shopping and everything? It always seemed a bit weird.
Oh, completely. And you know what's so funny about that? There's so many things about that we can talk about that are interesting. So one is, when I run into people out in the world, often, you know, I'll be with my kids, for example, or, you know, I'm in my yoga clothes or whatever it is. My students don't recognize me on the street. That's number one. They will walk right by me. They have, because the context doesn't help them, give them any context for who I am. So that's one thing that I think is hilarious. I think the other thing that's really interesting is just noticing how complicated it can be, although it's very lovely, to have social connections with your students, because I think we all want to be closer to our students. Sometimes our students want to be closer to us. We'll have dinners together. It's lovely. And at the same time, I think they have the experience, and I always have it, of like, how do they really want me to show up right now? Do you know what I mean? Do they really want me to let down my hair and stop acting like their professor? Or you know, am I here to be the professor and to continue playing that role? And those situations where the norms are ambiguous are always very tricky for people to navigate. You know, how much am I letting people behind the curtain versus, you know, have they really asked me to show up here in my role and just continue to do what I do in the classroom, even though I'm sitting in their living room right now? It's a very interesting dynamic to navigate, and one that I think illustrates, you know, another really interesting theme in the book, which is how context changes everything. And I think also, as, you know, individualistic actors, we lose track of that and think we should show up the same way in every situation. I just don't think that's good advice. I think you have to be sensitive to the fact that context changes very much what other people need from you. And it's important to be sensitive to that.
Yeah, it's like the horror of the away day, where you have the at-ease moment or the jacuzzi or the... And...
Yeah,
you know, people are sort of hanging out or in the robes because there's a spa. I mean, we're talking about some very nice away days here.
Absolutely. And, you know, I sometimes, it's very tricky for, you know, in power hierarchical relationships, there are always these dangers around crossing, you know, the lines or the boundaries of what's appropriate. They're, you know, sexual misconduct. They're, you know, high power individuals who will, you know, get into relationships with people who have much less power than them. And, you know, I often advise the people who I supervise, the women in particular, to be careful in those situations, because the norms that define what's appropriate behavior in, you know, at the jacuzzi, at the bar after the conference are murky. It's murky, right? It's one thing to be in a room giving a talk with, you know, high power individuals in the audience. You kind of have a sense for how people are supposed to behave in that context, but in the social aspects of those professional relationships, it's harder to notice when boundaries are being crossed, and then sometimes things escalate in ways that that aren't really desirable for some of the parties, because you're taking your cues from people with more power who are failing to recognize that they still have power over you, even though you're in the jacuzzi or the bar. You know, people with power aren't aware of the effect that they have on other people and how people become incapable of protecting their own boundaries in the presence of a high power.
Exactly, because people in power have often got to be in power by virtue of their force of will, sometimes. By the conditions around them, that they were, you know, they were the ones that would spoke loudly, and they're not aware of other people. You get that a lot, don't you? I mean, surprisingly consistent in leadership characteristics. But it's a fatal flaw, which brings you right down the slippery slope like snakes and ladders all the way to the bottom, because what got you there won't keep you there. You say, when we act out of fear, we create the world we are afraid of. I mean, that is an incredibly apposite for these times, these current times. How are you acting at the moment? What's your role at the moment? Are you at home? What's it like where you are? Is it life as normal, or are you used to the whole remote working thing?
You know, I'm somewhat introverted. You wouldn't necessarily know that because of the context that we're in. Like, you know, I'm here on your podcast and I've got to talk, so that's what I'm doing, and I'm happy to be here with you. But, you know, as many academics are, I would describe myself as a fairly introverted person. And to be perfectly honest, when it first became apparent to me that it was a good idea to stay at home to slow down the spread of the virus, I was very, very happy to do that. And so, you know, that hasn't been difficult at all. I would say that you know, in terms of insights about power, it's been very interesting to notice, again, how the leaders of government are seizing on their power and wielding it or not, and to recognize how that feels. So I feel also very fortunate that the governor of my state, Gavin Newsom, acted very early during the COVID crisis and put shelter at home orders in place. It was very early in the United States he did that, because we had the first cases of the COVID-19 disease cropping up right in my home. So I've been sheltering in place for a long time, and it's starting to look like we have slowed things down and flattened the curve here. And I just feel so grateful that he took that risk at a time when you know, a lot of people were still saying everyone's overreacting and you know, we're not really going to be hurt by this. I just feel so grateful that he did that. And I think it's been an interesting moment for power holders in particular to recognize that, you know, in a crisis situation, in any situation really, but, you know, in a crisis situation like the one we're in, nobody knows what the right move is. Nobody knows what the right move is. We don't know if the right thing to do is to shut everything down and then deal with the effects on the economy. We don't know whether we're going to think that we overreacted later. We don't know, you know, we just don't know. And the leaders of our organizations and of our governments don't know either. They don't know the right thing to do. And they have, every decision they make has huge effects on gigantic numbers of people. And the decision to wield power in an authoritative, almost autocratic way feels very high risk in a culture like where I live, and in some ways in a culture like where you live. There is a huge risk associated with it. And I think a lot of people don't realize that those decisions are made in a context where the leaders don't know if they're right or not, but they have a responsibility to use the power they have to protect their constituents. And they're taking risks every time they act. I just think it's very interesting that we think of the people with power as, you know, as not experiencing risks and not being at risk. And I think it's been interesting to recognize, you know, there are people who are quite hesitant to use the power that they have because of the risks that come with being wrong, potentially. And we sometimes lose track of that. So I just think it's been very interesting to notice that part of what it takes to use power well in a position of power is to accept that that comes at great personal risk to you as the power holder. And you have to be willing to take the risk, or you can't use the power that you have in a responsible way. Nobody knows the right thing to do. You just have to take action and try to let people know that you're thinking about them and try to get them on board. But yeah, I think it's very easy to be critical. It's very easy to be critical of a situation like this when the people who are supposed to know everything don't. It's just a fact of life.
Deborah, thank you for being on the Bokomi podcast and making the time to share. I hope you can come over to the UK soon, because I know there's lots of people who want to meet you.
I will look forward to that. Thank you for your interest.
Deborah Grunfeld's book, Acting with Power, Why We Are More Powerful Than We Believe, is published by Profile Books and is on the most wanted list for May 2020 at Bokomi.com, where you can sign up to our monthly Most Wanted newsletter or get access to our author intelligence service, connecting your company to brilliant minds for virtual events, meetings, video Q&As and podcasts. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to subscribe for more on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you take your audio fix. And if you have a moment, please rate and review the podcast. All positive feedback creates a happy ding of dopamine in my brain. Thanks again to Deborah Grunfeld, to Hannah and Valentina at Profile Books, to Rachel Cody for the edit, and Poddington Bear for the music. Bye for now.
I love Bokomi.